Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 85, where we are discussing another in our series of episodes concentrating on the Carnegie Mellon School. We are discussing the book Organizations by James March and Herbert Simon. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the book, mainly its second edition, which was released in 1993. To learn more about the text and the Carnegie Mellon School series, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Leamington Spa in the Midlands of England.
Hi, this is Greta coming from Windsor.
Hi, this is Leonardo calling from São Paulo, Brazil.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And welcome to another episode in our Carnegie Mellon series. This is the sixth one that we've done. It's been a while, but we've covered quite a number of classic texts from the Carnegie Mellon School in the past. This one is yet another. James March and Herbert Simon's Organizations. And I think most of us, I think we're all kind of in the second edition on this one. Okay, the first edition was 1958. The second edition is 1993. In comparison to some of the other ones, we've done exploration, exploitation before. We actually did a couple of chapters of this book in episode 4 as part of a discussion of organization learning. However, we did not do the entire book. And, you know, after such a long time and looking at, you know, which books have been cited and which of the works of the school have had the greatest impact, it just was really, really hard not to talk about the book by March and Simon, Organizations. Catherine, why don't you give us a quick rundown of the idea behind the book, and we'll get started with the conversation.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Well, Organizations was published in 1958 by Wiley, and it really pushed the study of organizations into the mainstream of academic writing about business. So it was a seminal text in terms of the Carnegie Tech School, where the focus of research was on organizational behavior and the application of things such as decision analysis, management science and psychology, as well as theories such as bounded rationality to the understanding of the organization and the firm. So Carnegie School, as we know from the other podcasts as well, was renowned for taking an integrative approach to research. And the book has been described as a propositional inventory of organization theory by the authors themselves, and few of us would disagree with that. It has also played a pioneering role in studying cognitive processes underlying boundedly rational human beings. Through this representational approach, March and Simon defined and explicated key mechanisms of individual and organizational decision making. Organizations provided an empirically based understanding of human behavior and coordination and set up core scientific criteria for creating the cumulative body of management and organization research. Some use it as a guide to organizational theory prior to 1958, as a useful source of propositions about organizations, and to others, it is an icon of a prehistoric age, which are the words of March and Simon themselves in the second edition. So as Tom said earlier, the second edition was published 35 years later, and the introduction is absolutely worth a read to anybody who hasn't read the second edition. In it, Martin and Simon appear to have mellowed somewhat and are more philosophical about their contribution to organization studies, with slight tongue-in-cheek comments that they are probably not much wiser now than they were then. They acknowledge that the main change from the original book, of course, is the social context from the late 1950s. The rhetoric, ideology, and reality of relations amongst ethnic and gender groups obviously had changed. However, they do offer possibly the definitive definition of an organization that I have ever read. Perhaps that definition is a good place to start our discussion today.
Yeah, it would be a good place to start. Now, before I do that, I would like to highlight one other thing. You know, we talk about it as a propositional text. Now, in the back, You know, one of the things that the way that they built the book, it literally is just a couple hundred propositions, all kind of focused on different aspects of organization. Many of them are proposed, definitely proposed as a research agenda. And if you go back to the very end of the book, the index of variables, what they do is they basically come up with some 200 variables. And what they're doing in the course of the book is trying to propose all of the relationships among these multiple hundreds of variables. And that would be like one massive wide research agenda. So every single place where you read in the book, and this is, I mention this because this is something I have not seen in any other publication. I don't know if you all have, but you know, every section introduces a variable and connects it to other variables and says, this is what we propose to be true, or this is what the state of the literature was in the late 50s as known to be true. We would not find a text like that nowadays, I don't think, because it's so vast, it's so comprehensive. It's mind-boggling to me. I don't know what you all think.
I totally agree with you, Tom, and thanks for pointing this out, because I didn't see this index. I was wondering what the numbers were referring to. And this is quite impressive to cover such a broad scope of topics in one book. Perhaps it's also impossible to publish a book like this but at the current time, because people prefer, or the publishers prefer, you to go more deeper into a topic rather than the breadth. I don't know what your thoughts are, but definitely it's impressive, and it gives a good overview of what the topics of org theory, org studies were at the time, and perhaps also a good place of reference to assess how org studies evolved from the 50s and 60s.
I was very interested to read a little bit about how the book was received at the time. It didn't attract immediate universal praise, but certainly some perhaps grudging respect from other academics. At the time, people like Kaufman said it was surely destined to occupy a prominent place in the literature and organizations for many years to come, and praised it as an impressive intellectual tour de force. Really, I read this book as a call to arms for the academic community in the late 50s, early 60s, to make organizational studies and theory a proper science. And they're very vocal about the need for empirical research to back up what academics in this arena are doing for organization studies to be seen as a, inverted commas, proper science. There are a couple of allusions in the book to biological sciences, and given their background, it's obvious that they're saying that without proper scientific data, i.e. quantitative research, then, you know, as an area, an academic area, organization studies can't be taken seriously. In doing so, they lay out where everyone needs to go next to achieve that. And it's absolutely stunning, as you say, Tom, you know, the breadth and depth of what they've actually put together. But I could imagine a graduate or an academic in the early 60s slamming the book shut and thinking, you know, what are these guys expecting me to do here? Because there's a general tone of voice, which is actually quite different from the introduction to the second edition, which is kind of slightly hectoring in parts and not very humble. And it was interesting, I read an interview with James March, which was published not long before he died, I think, in 2013, where he actually talked about the arrogance that they had at that point. But maybe that was exactly what was needed. Now, not everybody obviously took up the invitation in terms of the research. But in a way, I think the literature could be divided between pre-publication of organizations and post. It's an obvious milestone in the evolution of organization studies, and a really important one too. It's not an easy read. You know, from a practitioner's perspective, I guess you're always looking at an academic text for guidance and solutions, and there is some of that in there, but this is very much aimed at an academic audience and is very much a call to arms for academics to take the science of organization studies seriously. by backing it up with quantitative empirical research and distinguishing between fancy and fact. So they dismiss people in a way, not dismiss totally, but talk about the scientific management case studies that went before it as fancy rather than fact. And this calls for change. That was my reading of it.
No, just to point out some things that, based on what you said, first of all, as we were discussing, when I saw this index of propositions, came to my mind this idea that, well, this resembles like, this is something like an algorithm. We are programming what our organization should be or must be, I don't know. All the propositions are something like, if X, then why? If this, so that. And so this is very interesting because this sounds like a mechanical thing, but in the same way they say that propositions about organizations are statements about human behavior. And all that propositions has some idea of how human will receive a stimulus and act in sequence. So this is very interesting because this is something that maybe sounds like mechanical, put together some sociological ideas about human interaction and propositions about human cognitions and human behavior. And this is something that we don't find much on the literature, especially sociology and psychology doesn't talk with each other. And they put this together in the very beginning of the book, the chapter 3 and 4 maybe. It's all about how our organization is a community that has a reward system and how people behave based on the stimulus of this social structure that there is, or social system that they mentioned that there is an organization. So they are discussing with the classical literature, but also with the split between sociology and psychology that is still today very, very broad.
Yeah, I would also add that they did include in there some commentaries about which variables or which propositions would be easier to test than others. It's not just that they laid out all of this stuff and said, here's the mass, you know, the big research agenda for organizations. Here are some things that we think would be easier to solve because it either drew from stuff that was already out there in the 1930s, 1940s, but they also identified some things that said that we perceive that some of these propositions are important, but we're not so sure that they're necessarily testable, and here's why. But in the process of relating all of these ideas together, it's not a dry reading of just the mechanics of it. They did include quite a lot of analysis, and their own personal experiences did shine through. So that you get a sense that they know what they're talking about and that there's something behind what they have. It's just that we needed the science to go on and pursue it. With that said, I think, Catherine, your suggestion to discuss how did they define organizations would probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, I just love this definition in the introduction to the second edition. It says, organizations are systems of coordinated action among individuals and groups whose preferences, information, interests, or knowledge differ. Organization theories describe the delicate conversion of conflict into cooperation, the mobilization of resources, and the coordination of effort that facilitate the joint survival of an organization and its members. These contributions to survival are accomplished primarily through control over information, identities, stories, and incentives. Organizations process and channel information. They shape the goals and loyalties of their participants. They create shared stories, an organization ethos that includes common beliefs and standard practices. They offer incentives for appropriate behaviors. Pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, not only that, when you think about Carnegie Tech, when you think about what they were looking at, they talk a lot about industrial organizations, but that passage you just read is not confined to industrial organization, I don't think. I think it was a good way of capturing the breadth or, you know, the extent to which they're thinking about organizations as any sort of a collective body, not just industry.
Yeah, that's kind of what Leonardo was saying as well about the human side that they acknowledge, which would have been unusual at the time. unexpected at the time, moving from that scientific management model?
Especially because one of the works they discuss a lot, the classical works, they deal with bureaucracy. I feel that there is a little thought in Marc Simon that organization is different from bureaucracy. Maybe because bureaucracy is the structure of the organization is the channels of communications. I feel how all the stimuli response device that people, in order to people to behave inside this bureaucracy. So because we have this chapter that he discusses Merton, Goodner, Selznick, which we have episodes on, and what these works have in common is to discuss how the formal organization is something and the informal organization maybe is more important than the formal one. Maybe we have to keep this in mind. We have to say that informal organizations is important, but they are not talking about how people behave inside these informal organizations. I have a feeling that they are talking about something more deeper than we are always discussing the literature about organizations.
Well, at the same time, I think their definition of an organization is pretty broad. If you look at page 21, they have a bit of a manifesto why we should or study organizations as social scientists. And they say the significance of organizations as social institutions that shape the behavior of people. And one of the things that they point out is, you know, the amount of time, the sheer amount of time that people spend inside organizations. And somewhere in around these pages, they also give some examples. It's actually the page before. You know, the United States Steel Corporation, they mentioned the Red Cross, the New York State Highway Department, the New York State government. So they're pretty encompassing in their definition of what an organization or a formal organization is. I think, you know, adding the term formal is more a matter of rhetoric rather than defining it from informal. And what they say in our society, and I quote, preschool children and non-working housewives are the only large groups of persons whose behavior is not substantially organizational. And in that sense, I think, like, you know, that's like the biggest argument you can make why we need to study it as an institution that shapes the behavior of people. And then they go on, you know, making this argument why, you know, organizational communication is so influential as, you know, one mechanism to shape the behaviors of people, because it's targeted, because, you know, you directly target the people you want to reach. The communication is very well shaped, what you want to communicate, you know what the audience is about. And so that's like one of the sociological arguments, I would say, why it is important to study it. The arguments that they make there are still valid today. If you look at the sheer amount of research being done in the social sciences and how much of it is organizational, still, if we look into explaining phenomena that are organizational, we see that, you know, news reporters and politicians refer to the economists to say something about organizations rather than us as an academic community. You know, this book is making a big argument why their assumptions don't always hold up. And, you know, that was knowledge that was developed in the 50s. And I think, you know, the way the science organization studies developed as a field is very much in line, you know, with the notions of bounded rationality, with the programs of action. And I'd love to talk more about the content of the book, but what I see developing in the book is a way less scientific managed, but much more emergent view of what an organization is about. As it constantly develops, taking into account, you know, the limitations of humans, the cognitions of the humans and their motivations, rather than seeing them as just an instrument that is a slave to the machine.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Greta, because they talk about passage not long after the passage that you just cited in the beginning of page 25, when they actually get into the, you know, what is it that they're trying to accomplish with these propositions. And you start to see the sort of, like, you know, instead of looking at organizations as machines, you start to see the theme about them looking at organizations as organisms. So going back to images of organization, which we covered in a previous episode, That was a marked difference in the way of thinking about organizations. And in page 25, they talk about the types, you know, where these propositions are, what these propositions are trying to explain. Okay, you know, you just say that there's a whole bunch of propositions there, a whole bunch of these variables, but what is it that they're really trying to get after? And you can kind of see that it's definitely not the mechanistic view of the organization. Three categories is what they, but they said three broad classes. The first one was that propositions that assume organizational members, and particularly employees, are passive instruments capable of performing work and accepting directions, but are not initiating action. One whole set of propositions are just based on the role of the member. Second one was propositions assuming that members bring to their organizations attitudes, values, and goals, which is what members contribute to the organization. And then the third one was propositions assuming that organization members are decision makers and problem solvers. At least in my reading, that third broad class dominates the majority of the book. A lot of it is about decision making, about how to make decisions, what data you need, or what are you going to consider if you're going to pursue, like, for example, Chapter 7 covering innovation. It's all about, you know, we've got problems in the organization. How does an organization manage fixing the problems, thinking about novel solutions? How does it handle novelty? which was a really, really fascinating read. All of this is very much thinking about behavior and thinking about the individual contributions to the organization, not just members as turning the crank of the machine.
Just to mention, Tadki, this is very interesting because all this starts with the members accepting to be part of organization and being able or willing to contribute to the organization. This remembers me of Barnard. When we go back to Chester Barnard, all the zone of indifference, zone of acceptance that makes people being able to work for the organization, and then we reward system, not only monetary things, and this is something that Martin Simon said a lot. All the idea that all the sociological ideas from this book come from this this relationship between members, how recognition will be play part on the daily routines of organization. There is a proposition very interesting that they say organizations with vertical mobility tends to be more recognition from the members than others that are more that they have more stable reward system, something like that. This is think comes from chapter 3 and 4 when you are discussing motivational rewards, and all they are doing are systematizing the sociological ideas of how people behave in small groups, in the same way that Barnard said 30 years before they have to be part of the organization. They want to be part of the organization. We have to make this reward system work.
I was going to jump into chapter 4 a little bit more because, you know, on the one hand, the members, obviously, they have, you know, we get into how they participate, but it doesn't necessarily assume that the members want to participate. There's like an extent to which they participate. And this is where, like, for example, chapter 4, we talk about the criteria for how employees decide whether or not to participate. And, you know, what are the inducements and the ways in which they could contribute or not contribute? What causes them to want to stay in the organization versus what causes them to want to leave? And you know, I'm reading that section and I've looked at more recent work that was on organizational commitment. And boy, do they sound very similar. Now, the more recent obviously puts a lot of empirical work behind what Simon and March were saying in here. But there is an example of where I have seen that proposition before. And I understand where this was coming from. And then go back and take another look and, you know, with sort of fresh eyes at the literature that followed. And you can kind of see the connection. And so in a lot of ways, this shows how prescient March and Simon were as they were laying out all of these different variables. The desirability of staying or leaving the organization, the ease of movement, options to stay in the organization if you move to some other segment of it or whatever. All of those are they're referenced in the commitment literature.
Tom and Leonardo, you really hit like the meat of the middle part of the book. And, you know, the aims of this part of the book is really to replace this instrumental view of the employee or the human subject, so to say, as a member of the organization that have wants, that have motives and has drives. And I actually enjoyed the way they structured these chapters. I would actually have reversed them. Because one is, you know, what are the motivations of an organizational member to participate, to be part of the organization, or to leave? And the other one is to produce. So to actually, you know, contribute to the conduct of work, to contribute to the value of the organization. So I would see that as step two. It's mostly like a lit review of, you know, what was the research so far? And what have they said and how can we kind of synthesize that? Like, you know, nowadays that would be like an Academy of Management's annals paper, and then scope out the research agenda for it. So let's say this is just an old version of an annals paper and what's being done in these chapters. But it clearly shows, you know, we need to take this body of literature seriously, and we need to get rid of the scientific management view of the employee or the human subject, because it's actually hurting the organization. That's, for instance, what they showed in the previous chapter, that, you know, when you treat the employee as an instrument, you have certain assumptions about them which don't hold up, and then it's actually detrimental to what you try to achieve. So I really liked, like, you know, the simple framework that they put up with, like, the also the figures are very informative to show like how the factors are related, the intended consequences, the unintended consequences we see returning. I enjoyed reading these chapters, to be honest.
Yeah, and for those who may be a bit intimidated by the density of the material, the figures are very helpful. I will say that much. I just happen to have open in front of me right now figure 3-7, and this is on page 84. Yeah, what they do with the proposition is that they tell you straight up, like, there's an axiom. There's like a set of things that they propose as an axiom, and they mark them in the text. Like in the top of page 85, facing the same figure, you have an example of an axiom. Four available targets for identification about individual goals. So they list them out and say, all right, this, we're going to use this as a start point. And they mark it as an axiom. They even assign it a number. And then they go down further and talk about, like, for example, a proposition. The stronger the individual's identification with a group, the more likely that his goals will conform to his perception of group norms. And then it gives a, using a numerical code, it gives you the X and the Y, you know, X causes Y kind of a thing. What the figures do then is, after they've laid on about 20 different variables and multiple propositions, is that they then diagram them as a visual cue. So you can kind of see how they're piecing it together. This is not to say that, you know, later on you may find that there should be additional arrows or other arrows or whatever, but at least they give you a good visual. And 3.7, the particular figure that I have open, this is all about factors affecting the perceived consequences of evoked alternatives. That is, an alternative presented to an individual for changing their identification, or I have to go back to where they mention in the text 3.7.
I think these were the motivations to produce.
Yeah.
So it's like, how many action alternatives are there for an individual? What are the consequences of these alternatives? And the value attached to these consequences. So that was like the broad framework of this chapter. So alternatives are like, you know, you're tasked to do a task, I suppose, as an example. What are the alternatives? Like, you know, what are other things you could work on? And thinking about reward structures, etc.
Yeah, size of the group, the strength of group pressures. I mean, it's a whole bunch of different things. And a lot of these figures are also connected. This particular figure links to other figures in the book. This comes out of chapter 3, obviously, and they had about 75, I mean, a really huge number of variables that they were all putting together about intra-organizational decisions, what members decide to do. By sort of chaining, you know, breaking it out into different components, it helps to, you know, allow you to take big chunks of ideas and show how they connect with other big chunks of ideas. Like you could probably take all the figures and you could lay it out on a, we would call it a horse blanket. I don't know what terms you use, but basically one of those really big charts that is too big to fit on one page, but you just connect it together and it gives you the full visual of what they were trying to say.
Just going back to, well, exactly what you're saying, Tom, about how useful these models are. The last podcast I was involved in was the Goldner one, Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy. And I found the model, which is figure 3.4, really helpful with that. At the heart of it there is the visibility of power relations. And the diagram is really helpful in showing the intended results and the unintended results, which we know from that is a classic example of the unanticipated or unintended consequences of using bureaucracy as a means of control and improving productivity. What I like about it as well is that it helps us to understand it. It stimulates thought about it and stimulates the next stage of thinking, which is, you know, what has been left unexplained perhaps by some of these models as well. And they make the point there about Goldner, which is interesting for those of us who are involved in episode 78. A particular puzzle that they point to is why the increase in supervision doesn't improve the why is the supervisory response to low productivity to increase supervision? But that is really helpful throughout the book. So there is quite a lot of propositions, but the models that they use definitely help explain a lot of quite complex information much more easily.
Perhaps we can push forward to just sort of introduce the later chapters, because, you know, the structure obviously is kind of the same, but it's interesting the way that they present bounded rationality. That chapter 6 is one that gets a lot of attention, but chapters 5 and 7 are also worth mentioning, because chapter 5 is about conflict in organizations. This is probably one where they take a slightly different approach than what they use in other chapters, because what they try to do is to characterize a whole different wide slate of types of conflict and how we react to it. It starts with, it's sort of like a mathematical model. I saw a little bit of garbage can influence in here. What they were trying to talk about here is the main classes of conflict could be individual, organizational, or interorganizational. They sort of say, all right, we're mildly interested in interorganizational. Let's stick with individual and organizational. And then what they do is they distinguish different sources of conflict as something is unacceptable, some things are incomparable, or some things are uncertain. Okay, so if that's the type of conflict, then they create this matrix, which basically takes the positions of two entities, two actors, individuals or organizations, and says that if you see the situation as, you know, good, bad, whatever, and then here's the kind of a conflict that you're potentially going to see. You're going to see things as being, you know, if it's a one particular mix, it's going to be a conflict over unacceptability or incomparability. Or if it's this other combination, it's uncertainty or something like that. Then from there, they start to get into the propositions. But I thought it was fascinating because, you know, I have colleagues who do a lot of work in conflict. What they do is, interestingly enough, is that they use a lot of the same ideas that were presented here as sort of like their start point. This was very emergent, I think, in the late 1950s. It wasn't covered so detailed, but then you read the stuff now on conflict, and especially conflict in teams. There is an incredible amount of work being done in conflict in teams. You know, even though they are certainly much further along in the depth of explanation, you can hear the echoes of this type of analysis at the foundation of it. And it's sort of interesting to see how this whole idea, this whole field emerged as a result of trying to understand what was going on with conflict dynamics within the organizations that March and Simon had worked with.
How I read this chapter was really like a transition chapter to move from this motivational view of the problems associated with using human subjects in organizations towards more cognitive view. And the chapter 5, Conflict in Organizations, starts with this definition March and Simon propose of how we should define conflict. Coming back to that decision-making lens that they take throughout the book, they kind of say that the term is applied to a breakdown in the standard mechanism of decision-making, so that an individual or group experiences difficulty in selecting an action alternative. So that's very abstract. And they say, so a conflict occurs when an individual or a group experiences a decision-making problem. You know, the whole chapter is about going into, you know, unpacking that definition. I read it as really setting the stage for the last two chapters, where they really dive into, you know, how human beings are limited in their ability to learn and solve problems. Like the conflict you could substitute for, you know, problems encountered. And then it goes into problem solving or solving the conflict. What types of information go into that, and why the economic notion of the homo economicus, the rational human being, doesn't always hold up in an organizational context.
It's interesting, like Greta said, it's a kind of transition from the more sociological part to this one more talking about the organization as a whole, maybe. I felt a little bit like kind of conservative part in a way that everything that runs away from the standard operating procedures are a cause of conflict. And thinking about the literature today, maybe we are more embracing the conflict a little bit more than they are talking about. And I will wait to discuss about innovation, but it's something interesting because maybe I can make the bridge here, because the idea of innovation that they say have to do with conflict, because innovation for them is a kind of change of attention focus from their more regular concerns to the search of new alternatives. And this is conflict. This is uncertainty, all the things that they say. I don't know if they say this in a good or in a bad way, you know. Oh, organizations have to embrace conflict, they have to deal with that, or they are saying that everything that runs away from the standing operate procedure is bounded, rational, and leads to conflict, and this is bad for the organization. I don't know what they are talking here and if I am getting this right.
Well, I would say that, you know, what they're doing is they're saying what is, not necessarily what should be. I think it's left to, you know, we need to know what is the case. When it comes to conflict, and also when it comes to the innovation side, you know, what they're saying is this is the relationships that that we see that need to be empirically tested. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the existence of that relationship is either good or bad. It just simply is. I mean, that's the way that I took it. Now, there is a sense that, well, unmanaged conflict in the abstract is not good. So then, you know, there's an additional step that would have to come beyond when you bring this into practice and say, all right, well, this is what we've learned about conflict since 1958. What then do we talk about tools or whatever? That's not, I don't think that's really what they were after here.
Yeah, perhaps not directly related, but one thing that I found really interesting in this chapter and it got me thinking was, you know, the way they apply this decision-making lens. Understanding, like, when does conflict arise in organizations is, you know, when there are differences in goals and or differences in perceptions or interests, that's known. But what they say, there is a felt need for joint decision making. That's when the conflict arises. You want to resolve the difference. And I don't know what you thought about that, but it got me thinking, like, you know, when do you experience a conflict yourself? You know, that's the easiest. But, you know, when you think about, like, you know, intergroup conflict, when is there this need? When do they feel this need that they jointly have to make that decision? For instance, thinking about, you know, going a little bit into the empirical context of the final chapter of innovation, for instance, you know, what concept do you pursue? Do you go with concept A or B? There are differences in where to go. When can you resolve a conflict by making this decision? We each pursue our own goal, which, you know, in one of the studies I did in the Japanese multinational where I studied an innovation project, they just decided to build two pilot plants because they couldn't agree on the concept. They just tried to explore both. I'd love to hear your views of, you know, this felt need for joint decision-making to add that to the definition of conflict in organizations.
I was equally struck I really loved also that they talk, you know, not just the concept of initiation, the first section in there, you know, do you do something, which itself is a question that we for example, in some of the readings that that I've worked with, you know, there's sort of like this bias for action. But here, what they're talking about is, do you actually do something? How do you actually start doing something? Which could both become sources of conflict. And I imagine as, you know, when we start thinking about innovation in practice, those are exactly the sort of things that come up. And the example that you gave, Greta, this is probably far more depth than we would want to get into, but there's had to have been a whole bunch of mini decisions made along the way while trying to work around the conflict that ultimately arrived at that solution. Those are the things that that they're really trying to get out in the open in this chapter, is all of those, you know, how we navigate all through those conflicts to arrive at whether or not we actually do something or do we keep the status quo. And then ultimately, how do we plan for it? I mean, there was at the end of the chapter is a whole section about planning innovation. You can kind of see how do you analyze whether the change is working the way that you want? It's going consistent with the goals that that you set for it. How do you decide whether or not you're going to do, say, what I saw in here was kind of like, do you just go ahead and take a chunk of the organization and let them be the source of the innovation and shield the rest of the organization? Or do you try to embed innovation throughout the organization? Those are all things that they address, not always directly, but some of the things that we've seen since that sort of come out as decisions as to how do you actually do experimentation? How do you scale up, scale out once you've decided on an innovation? A lot of the propositions that they put into that chapter sort of manifested as the innovation literature expanded over time.
To add that something that I missed in my last comment, how the organization can decide if some solution that I develop is not a product of my genius or not a product of my bounded rationality. I miss some concept of effectiveness and efficiency in the book, because the idea is that if I follow all the standard operating procedures, did I reach an efficient organization or not? This is not all steps to make, or we have to pay attention to all that thing that they're doing. So how can I avoid inefficient using all that steps?
I think that's a great question to pick up in part two. To what extent can we now explain more about organizations adopting this framework and what is missing out? And perhaps, you know, the research in the past 70 years have helped to explain. But I love to go a little bit deeper into, you know, the chapter 6 and 7. I think chapter 6 is really what the March and Simon book is famous for, introducing this notion of bounded rationality and how it affects the way people behave in organizations and how organizations behave. The meat of the argument they started to introduce is on page 160, where they say that, like classic economic theory, classic organization theory, you know, like scientific management and, you know, the early theories of administration, fail to make explicit the subjective and relative character of rationality. They go on saying the organizational and social environment in which the decision maker finds himself determines what consequences he will anticipate, what ones he will not, and what alternatives he will consider, and what ones he will ignore. And these variables, they state, and I think, you know, almost an exclamation mark could be added to this sentence, cannot be treated as unexplained independent vectors, but must themselves be determined and predicted by the theory. And there he really sets the stage for, you know, a research agenda that takes into account the bounded rationality of human actors. And I think, you know, they make some strides in this chapter, especially on page 191, where they start making attempts to see organizations and organizational processes through this lens of bounded rationality. They mention that, you know, optimizing in the organization should be replaced by satisfying, that the requirement that satisfactory levels of criteria variables be attained. And then they also say that the alternatives of action and consequences of action are discovered sequentially through search processes. And I like this idea of search processes. Continuously people are, you know, engaging in search to find, you know, what satisfies the conditions at that moment. And then what they develop is these repertories of action programs. And, you know, this is where I got excited, and I guess like others got excited as well. Action programs are developed by organizations and the individuals inside, and these serve as the alternatives of choice in recurrent situations. And in the new introduction they add to this version of the book, they actually said that if they would have written the book again, they would have expanded more on this notion of action programs. They go on, you know, they love their lists and their numberings. Each specific action program deals with a restricted range of situations. That's where the bounded rationality comes in, and a restricted range of consequences. Then they also say that these action programs are only loosely coupled together. You know, the loose coupling we see as return concept in institutional theory that develops later. But also, you know, an organization is not fully planned in advance, like the scientific management view they completely let go of. They say, you know, it's a search process, and then based upon, you know, what you, the input you get, having a bounded rationality, having a bounded set of things that are your inputs, you come to some action program, and these are loosely coupled together. And I guess, like Tom, you referred to the garbage can model of organizations a couple times. I think this is really where the connection comes into the book, right?
Indeed. I was thinking about the garbage can model when I read this this part of the chapter as well. The whole notion of satisficing as the alternative to optimizing, which is what they put, that they discuss early in the chapter. You know, this idea that it's not only infeasible or unlikely that you would ever be able to cognitively achieve an optimal solution to everything. It's all about searching. It's all about looking for what you can do to influence the situation at hand that you can see, that you can perceive, or that you recognize. Sequential, continuous, what have you. That never leads to an optimal solution. I think getting into what we might discuss in part two is this tendency that we still, in a way, expect, or we clamor for, some degree of optimization, some degree of expectation that an organization knows what it's doing to the point of being able to generate optimal solutions to problems, when in fact, these processes that they discuss really do lead us down the road of iterative, of whatever is good enough for the time being. I really like the way that they characterize it, because it does explain, it does capture a lot of how organizations struggle through things that are really, really big problems.
Yeah, I love that part of it as well. And I was thinking in the context of the challenges that we've all faced over the last 18 months as well, how we revert back to the routines and the rituals that we've always used to solve the same problems. And then we're surprised when we don't end up with the optimal solution at the end as well.
And one thing worth noting here is that, you know, this notion of rational behavior, Martin Simon actually referred back to the work of Chester Bernard, which I believe we also have an episode about. They don't completely came up with it themselves. There is some intellectual origins there.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.